Us han demanat la gent de la Diputació que cedeix les sales, si podríem ser molt puntuals, i a 9:15 finalitzar el debat, per tant tenim menys estona de la que havíem previst i sense preàmbuls anem a començar. Com sabeu, s'emmarca aquesta conferència en els cicles de debats d'educació que habitualment la Universitat Oberta i la Fundació promovem amb col·laboració puntuals d'altres institucions, i aquest cop tenim la col·laboració de la Diputació de Barcelona a través de la sessió d'aquesta sala i també del Consolat General dels Estats Units, que ha col·laborat a fer possible que la conferenciant, la professora Peggy Leavitt, estigui avui entre nosaltres. De fet, aquesta conferència de Peggy Leavitt inicia un petit cicle d'altres dues conferències que abordaran la qüestió de la immigració i de la diversitat relacionada amb el món educatiu. La propera conferència serà el 22 de novembre, es farà en el Foment de les Arts Decoratives, en el FAT, i tindrà com a ponent en Salvador Cardús, i desenvoluparà la ponència sobre la creació de les identitats des de l'escola, que ens sembla que és un dels aspectes fonamentals que avui també podrem abordar. Situant-nos avui, la possibilitat de tenir entre nosaltres a Peggy Leavitt ens va portar a pensar en un debat obert com aquest, a part d'altres activitats que hem fet amb ella i amb estudiosos del tema de la immigració, per tal de poder abordar un dels aspectes que, tot i que està present a la societat catalana i en la immigració, no el tenim perfectament incorporat ni en les anàlisis ni en les recerques, que és tot l'impacte de la transnacionalitat, el fet de que els immigrants, els col·lectius d'immigrants, les persones que han arribat o són fills de famílies arribades en el país de manera recent, no són persones que trenquen els vincles amb ni el seu entorn de procedència ni el seu entorn cultural familiar més immediat, i aquesta dialèctica que s'estableix de creació d'identitats en funció de la transnacionalitat, una relació bidireccional, perquè també hi ha una incidència en els països d'origen en funció de les comunitats que estan en aquest cas al nostre país, és un dels temes. Estats Units, que està, no diré de moda, però sí que té una forta tradició en els últims anys a l'hora de realitzar investigacions, i és un dels aspectes que més està portant a desenvolupar recerques en aquests moments, entre elles les de Peggy Leavitt, per tal d'abordar quina ha de ser les polítiques també educatives i com han de tenir en compte les polítiques educatives el fenomen de la transnacionalitat o del transnacionalisme en el món de la immigració. Per tant, això és el que li hem demanat a la professora Peggy Leavitt que desenvolupi avui. Com sempre, tindrem una oportunitat després de fer un diàleg, i abans de donar la paraula a la Peggy Leavitt, que farà la conferència en anglès, també us ho dic perquè si no teniu i el requeriu a la traducció simultània, doncs la podeu anar a sol·licitar, farem també la presentació més formal de la professora Leavitt.
No, bé, a veure, podeu entendre doncs que amb un focus temàtic com aquest que presentava el Jordi, doncs per als estudis de psicologia i ciències de l'educació de la UOC, en la col·laboració que mantenim amb la Fundació Jaume Bofill, doncs aquesta és una excel·lent oportunitat per de poder comptar avui doncs amb la professora Peggy Leavitt. La professora Leavitt és investigadora del Departament de Sociologia del Wellesley College de Massachusetts, també en el Hauser Center per Organitzacions No Lucratives, i és investigadora també del Weatherhead Center per a les Relacions Internacionals de la Universitat de Harvard. La professora Leavitt és autora de diferents llibres i articles que analitzen el fenomen de la immigració transnacional, dels quals destaquem The Transnational Villagers i The Changing Face of Home. Per nosaltres, com us deia, és una excel·lent oportunitat poder comptar amb la seva aproximació als importants desafiaments que planteja a la nostra societat el procés migratori i particularment els seriosos reptes que aquest fenomen planteja a dia d'avui en l'àmbit educatiu.
Professora Leavitt. Muchas gracias. Muchas gracias y buenas tardes. Y quisiera dar las gracias a la Fundación y a usted y a la Embajada por esa oportunidad de compartir con ustedes. Voy a hablar en inglés, dar mi charla en inglés y después voy a intentar hacer el diálogo en castellano. Y quisiera empezar diciendo que voy a hablar sobre la experiencia en Estados Unidos. O sea, mis comentarios están basados en mis propias investigaciones en Estados Unidos, tanto sobre dominicanos y otros grupos asiáticos y brasileños, irlandeses, y también sobre la literatura, otras investigaciones que han hecho mis colegas. Entonces, intento hacerles un panorama de los debates sobre la segunda generación y cómo cambia cuando se usa una óptica transnacional y qué tiene que ver con eso a la educación escolar. Y quisiera empezar contándoles un poco las historias de vida de algunos jóvenes que conocí cuando estaba escribiendo el libro que acabo de terminar, que se llama Dios no necesita pasaporte, y es como los inmigrantes contemporáneos están cambiando la panorama religiosa en Estados Unidos. Y hablé con dos chicas, se llaman Bindi y Sonali, son en los años 20, tienen 20 años más o menos, y me estaban diciendo que una carrera aceptable desde el punto de vista de sus papás es ser trabajar en una farmacia. Y me estaban contando de los muchos noches, sábados en la noche, cuando se reunieron juntos sus familias y otras familias, y se dieron cuenta que no fue que recibieron el mensaje que, bueno, tenemos amigos en el colegio, pero realmente nuestros amigos son los que con quien reunimos los fines de semana. Ahora voy a switch to English porque si no voy a estar aquí hasta las 10 hablando. Okay, these girls grew up in towns where there were very few other South Asians, and so when they did get together with these other families, it was as if they were finally at home. So one of them, Sonali, said that her mother continued to send her to school with chapatis and dal, in typical Indian food for lunch, where Bindi, the other girl, her mother had already given up by the time she was in middle school because she was just embarrassed by how her schoolmates responded to these foods. And so it was a relief to both of them to be around families that were like their own and to not have to worry about the smells that came from the kitchen when their friends came over and things like that. Now, both of the girls had moms who had little mandirs or temples in their houses where they had Indian gods that they took care of every day, but they never really told their children very much what those were about. And so when they were in high school, this group of families started to get together informally to say devotional prayers or bhajans. And so they would get together, they would say the prayers, and then it was really a social experience. And not only did they get together on Saturday nights, but they all shared each other's birthdays and eventually weddings and became a very close system of support. Now, they also said that you always knew that the other parents were watching you. So if you grew up in a town and you were with somebody that you shouldn't be with, or you were with or you were going somewhere where you shouldn't go, you always were looking over your shoulder because all of the parents sort of felt a collective responsibility for bringing up all the kids. And when it was their turn to be the host, to have everybody else come to their house to visit, they were very worried about being the perfect child, the perfect host, and nobody's parents had any problems telling everybody else how they should behave. And they were also always being compared to each other. So what one thing I thought was very poignant was that Sonali said that when she was in high school, she was always being asked, well, what do you want to do when you grow up? What do you want to do when you grow up? And she just said, I want to be an engineer, even though she had no idea what an engineer was, but she just felt so much pressure to sort of conform to that standard of being the good Indian child. Now, kids like Sonali and Bindi are really between a rock and a hard place. I don't know if that expression makes sense and to translate, but they're in a very difficult position because their parents want them to assimilate into American culture, but they have very mixed feelings about it. They want them to assimilate, but only so much. And the line between being too Indian and being too American is very unclear. And for kids, it's especially unclear for kids who don't belong to religious communities that really set that line down in the sand. And so kids feel that if they excel according to one standard, they're often going to fail according to another standard. And when they go to college, they have to figure this out by themselves outside of the context of their families. And so what I see, not just for these kids, but I see this at my own university, is kids that really never thought much about what it meant to be Muslim or what it meant to be Hindu, and they get to school and their classmates expect them to join the South Asian Students Association or the Hindu Students Association, and they're sort of seen as the representative of that group, but they don't really know very much about what that experience is. And so they seek out the Hindu student advisor or the South Asian student advisor, or they experiment with wearing a headscarf. And part of it's about, you know, not for the first time wanting to explore this on your own rather than your parents forcing you to explore it, and also very much a sense of comfort at finding other kids who have lived the same kind of experience as you, and that you don't have to explain what your family's like, what your parents are like, what kind of pressure you're under at home, because everybody's under the same kind of pressure and feels the same kind of thing. Now, these kids are being evaluated, a sort of well brought up test, every Saturday night, but they're also having a test about what does it mean to be an Indian American and relate to back to India, or what does it mean to be a Pakistani American and relate back to Pakistan. And so this is another test that has multiple evaluators or multiple masters. A lot of the families that I spoke with while writing this book took their kids back to India or Pakistan or Brazil on a regular basis. Some of them went back every summer. And there was always, some of these trips were remembered mostly in glowing terms, but there was also this feeling that you were being very, both you and your parents were being very much scrutinized to see whether you had been brought up sufficiently according to Indian culture or Pakistani culture. So let me tell you about Anika, who's now 32, and she lives in a small town that's near the Massachusetts border, and she actually belongs to one of the Hindu communities that I studied, which is called Swadhyay. And so she has a very clear moral framework that she's been brought up with, and even is one of the teachers that works with some of the younger kids to teach the Swadhyay ways. So she went back to India about 4 years ago with her father, and this was ostensibly a trip to try to find somebody to... It was a trip to visit her grandparents, but everybody knew that it was really about finding somebody to marry. And she was very sort of thrilled by feeling like she was in a place where Swadhyay values were being lived on an everyday basis, but there was something just a little bit off about them, and she couldn't figure out why. And she felt that, you know, if she didn't praise, you know, if she wasn't humble enough, if she didn't praise the food strongly enough, if she wasn't quick enough to get up and help out, she was going to be scrutinized. And she was sort of worried about getting it a little bit off. But when I went a couple of years later and interviewed her relatives, they were very beneficent about singing her praises. And she was right that they were watching her carefully, but they were also very, very satisfied by what they saw. They were willing to give her the benefit of the doubt because they saw that she was really trying. And this is what her uncle said. My brother visited with his daughter Anika in 1999, and we hadn't seen them in more than 5 years. We were wondering what she would be like. Some kids come back here and it's like they're allergic to India. They don't like the food, they don't like the dust or the heat. She was very different. She was very interested in everything. She was very respectful. She didn't wait to be waited on. I told my brother he had done a good job raising her. It's possible to bring up good Indian children in America. Now, these vignettes, I think, reveal several important things about the second generation experience. The first is that many children, not all, but many children, are living their lives in a thick and dense cross-border field of relationships that encompass people and places and goods and ideas and money from around the world. And while they're being raised in New York or Boston or Los Angeles, they're often profoundly influenced by places that are far away, even if they hardly ever visit those places or they never visit those places. And and these are also kids that are migrating back and forth between at least two sets of cultural values. And so at home and at school or in the neighborhood, eventually at the workplace, or when they're in their grandparents' house back in India, there's subsets of rules and expectations, and they also evaluate themselves with respect to different reference groups. And this, what I would call multiple embeddedness, or being rooted and nested in various places, represents resources, but it also represents challenges. Third, the second generation experience varies very much by gender and class. So what you can decide to do and how much agency or how much choice you have about acting on those choices is really a matter of whether you're a man or a woman and how much money you have. And finally, I think context really matters. So part of what I've been so fascinated by in my conversations the last couple of days is how different the Catalan context is from the United States context in terms of what we expect about diversity, our experiences with diversity, what we expect of diversity, what would be the end point for, that we're looking for in our society, what's the management of church and state like. And so these all of these different contextual factors really influence incorporation trajectories. And in addition, where you come from has a particular place in the world socioeconomic hierarchy. So if you come from a place that's poor and powerless, you're likely to fit into any receiving country in a poor and powerless position. Likewise, if the diaspora does well, like the Indian diaspora is doing well around the world, at the same time that India is also gaining a lot of economic power, then it's possible to sort of shift that socioeconomic power hierarchy, that global power hierarchy. So that place really matters. Now, there's a lot of work on, scholarly attention being paid to the second generation in the United States and the nature of the children of immigrants' economic and social incorporation. But a lot of that work only very superficially engages with work that's being done on transnational migration. And it continues to see what happens to the children of immigrants as a product of forces that are happening just inside the United States, rather than seeing them as a product of forces that are happening inside the country and outside the country as well. But a transnational perspective makes a different kind of argument. It says that people, as they become incorporated into the countries that receive them, they can also continue to invest and pray and vote and raise their children, in some cases, in the countries that they come from, and that these new two processes don't have to be antithetical to each other, and that in some cases they can mutually reinforce each other and sort of build upon each other. And so a transnational perspective also examines the way economic and political and religious institutions change when the constituencies that they serve are living these lives where they have feet in both worlds. So from this perspective, any analysis of immigration has to necessarily look beyond the nation-state container and ask what factors, if any, are affecting the lives of the second generation. And so while the children of immigrants, I think, are not likely to engage in their ancestral homes in the same way that their parents do, their lives can still be very, very influenced by people and places and values from far away. And so with respect to some aspects of their lives, the incorporation and their socioeconomic mobility is both a transnational and a national project. Now, okay. All right. So debates about immigrant incorporation in the United States are really, about the second generation, are really characterized by two camps. The first camp are the neo-assimilationists, who are sort of recuperating assimilation theory, which went out of fashion because it wasn't considered politically correct. And these people are saying, well, let's not throw the baby out with the bathwater. We are going to see second and third and fourth generations achieving socioeconomic parity with the native-born population. But we do have to recognize that race and ethnicity matter, but that the differences between today's immigrants and immigrants in the past are really overblown. Okay? And now a second side of this is the segmented assimilationists. And they say that what's really happening is that kids, parents and kids are being assimilated into three different strands of the American population in three different ways. So some are achieving socioeconomic mobility by assimilating mainstream values. Some are achieving socioeconomic mobility by retaining selective parts of their ethnic values and their ethnic practices, becoming economically assimilated, but remaining ethnic in certain ways, and that allows them to be achieve socioeconomic mobility. And then there are others who are assimilating into an underclass. So they reject mainstream values, and as a result, assimilate into an underclass that also feels socially excluded and marginalized. And sometimes kids and parents do this at the same rate, or sometimes they don't. So if we have selective acculturation, that's when parents and kids both hang on to ethnic values, but also become part of the home community, the host community. If we have consonant acculturation, that's when parents and kids both throw out ethnicity and adopt all the values of the mainstream. I'm simplifying this to make it easier to grasp. And then the dissonant acculturation is when parents want to remain ethnic and kids reject that and are more likely to assimilate into this underclass and reject those values. And I think there's an emerging consensus that selective acculturation, especially in terms of language retention, produces the most positive socioeconomic outcomes. And there's a recent study that sort of nuances this that reveals that in non-poverty neighborhoods, assimilation is positively associated with education and with psychological well-being, but also positively associated with more at-risk behaviors. So the same kids that assimilate and do well at school and feel good about themselves are also more at risk of joining gangs or getting into behaviors that aren't positive for them. So at the same time that these discussions about assimilation and segmentalist assimilation are going on, there's also debates. There are also those of us who are arguing for a transnational perspective. And that comes out of the idea that we need to get over methodological nationalism, or the assumption that social life automatically and logically takes place inside national borders. Because if we keep to that lens, we don't see what's happening, that things that are happening that are rooted in national context, but also transcend them. And so, to pick up on those kinds of dynamics, you have to trade in your national lens for a transnational lens. And that doesn't mean that you're going to deny the importance of the nation state, or say that things like formal political citizenship matters, or that everything's going to be transnational. It means that when you're asking questions or studying the immigrant experience, you have to open it up from the beginning and say, how do people actually organize themselves? How do people actually identify themselves without assuming a priori that they are organized into groups that fit neatly within the nation state? And sometimes we find out that transnational factors have very little to do with the story, but sometimes we find out that they really do. So A transnational gaze sort of starts from a world that's boundaryless and borderless, and then asks what kind of boundaries and borders are created or arise in particular historical contexts and why. And instead of trying to privilege what's happening at the global level or what's happening at the local level, to hold those layers of social life and everything in between in conversation with each other so that you see how they mutually inform each other. And in some cases, as I said, transnational factors have very little to do with the story, and in other cases, a lot of what's going on is rooted in national context, but also transcends borders. So what do we get when we think about migration in this way? What do we come to understand? First, we come to see just how much migrants and their children organize aspects of their lives across borders. So they're still continuing to invest, they're still continuing to send their children back, so that they learn culture like Sonali and Bindi. They still are active in home country politics. They're still active in religious organizations that root them in the sending community. And these organizations, as I said, also change a great deal to enable this. So they change and they also enable this kind of dual membership or multiple membership. These activities then sort of make us reconsider what are we thinking when we talk about incorporation. So in the United States, at least, there's this idea that you go through a linear, irreversible process from one membership to another. You trade in your Dominican membership card for an American membership card. And what a transnational perspective suggests is that instead people are going to pivot back and forth between a home country and a host country orientation and other sites around the world where there are co-nationalists and co-religionists, because those are also salient places. And so instead of expecting full assimilation or full transnational involvement, we're going to see more and more that people continue to craft some combination of the two, and that changes over time at different stages of their life cycle. Okay. This view also kind of challenges what we think about generation, because that means that kids are being that production and reproduction are taking place across borders. So kids like Sonali and Bindi, even if they don't go back to India, are being raised in these places where their experience is very much informed by things that happen back in the homeland. And kids in the homeland are also growing up in these social spaces where they are also very influenced by what the Indian American experience is like. And so to think that there's an artificial cutoff between one generation experience and another generation experience isn't true in many cases. And in fact, in the United States, where there's this sort of constant replenishment by new immigrants now, Mary Waters and Tomas Jimenez say that at any point in time, each generation is a mix of cohorts, and each cohort has a mix of generations. The life experience of children raised in transnational social fields then are going to be constantly informed by new injections of social and cultural goods imported by each immigrant influx. And kids who are born in transnational social fields are also growing up in places where things like gender and race and class are measured according to different yardsticks. What it means to be middle class in the Dominican Republic is different than what it means to be middle class in the United States. So how do you think about things like race when in Latin America it's possible to whiten your skin as you move up the socioeconomic hierarchy, and in the United States we think about race in a very, very dichotomous way where you're either black or white and you have one drop of black blood and that means you're a person of color. How do you think about class when somebody is getting housing assistance from the U.S. government, but also building a house back in their homeland, or at the same time can't afford to pay their rent in the United States because they're sending so many remittances back to support their families? So what I want to suggest to you is that these are socially constructed categories that are constructed across borders using multiple sort of systems of values and measurements, and then how we have to think about remediating things like poverty or educational outcomes also needs a transnational response. Okay. And finally, and we also don't we don't only have to think about the relationship between local to local connections. So we also have to think about the many levels of the transnational social field. So these kids aren't just affected by what goes on in India and the United States. They're also affected by national culture and global culture. So if I want to understand the experience of Salvadorans living in Los Angeles, for example, I am going to trace what goes on between that neighborhood in Los Angeles and that village back in El Salvador. But I also have to ask to what extent the U.S. government and the Salvadoran government, or the U.S. church and the Salvadoran Catholic Church, are involved. Or if I'm studying the lives of Brazilian immigrants, their religious lives, I'm going to look at how that sending church and receiving church are connected to each other, but I also have to ask how that sending church relates to its denomination back in Brazil, and the immigrant church relates to its denomination in the United States, and then how those kinds of dynamics might form national, regional, and global kinds of connections that are also affecting what's going on in the local, on the local level. So the challenge really is to bring this scholarship on, bring a transnational optic or a transnational perspective to research on the second generation. And so far, that's only been very superficially done. So we have people like Alba and Ni, who are the sort of archetypical assimilationists, who admit that transnationalism is an important phenomenon for the first generation, but are convinced that for the second generation, that it's unlikely to continue. And they use the example of the Chinese, who were very involved in their homeland for three or four generations, but when the immigrant laws changed, they were forced to sort of put down roots in the United States and break those ties. And they're using The people who see very little transnationalism among the second generation are using measurements like things like homeland trips or remittances or circular migration, being active in the politics of your ancestral home, or whether you use the media from that country. And so there's another big study of the second generation in New York. And they also find that there's some homeland involvements on the part of all of the groups that they study. There's more among Dominicans, then followed by Colombians, Ecuadorians, Peruvians, and West Indians, that there's some transnational activities on some measures. And then among the Chinese and the Russian Jews, they sound very little. And so it's by no means obvious, these authors conclude, that transnational parents will produce transnational children. And I agree that most of the second generation are not going to be involved in their parents' homes with the same frequency and in the same doing the same kinds of activities and with the same level of intensity as their parents. But that people like Sonali and Bindi, who have been raised primarily in the United States, are socialized primarily into that context. But as I tried to show with my vignettes that I began with, they're also being raised in this social context that's very, very much infused by influences from far away. And the organizations that touch them, like the religious organizations, or to the extent that their parents participate in cultural and political organizations, are also opportunities for connection back to the homeland. So the activities oriented towards the homeland aren't going to be a central part of their lives in the same way as their parents, but tampoco can we dismiss them as insignificant. And when you operationalize, when you study things like transnational involvements among the second generation as things like how many times do you want to have you gone home, and you know, are you fluent in Spanish? You miss a lot of things that go on underneath. So what I'm suggesting to you is that you don't have to be totally fluent in your ancestral tongue. Certainly I'm not, and I can communicate with people here. Or you don't have to want to go back to live in Mexico to be active in that village and to want to support Mexican activities there. So it's not a surprise that people who do more ethnographic work find more homeland-oriented activities among the second generation. And because they're taking this transnational social field or this social space that I've been proposing to you seriously and defining transnational activities as more than just economic and political involvements, but also as social and cultural and emotional and affective ties, they see much more activism among the second generation. Now, these activities vary by group. Vivian Louie found very stark contrasts between Dominicans and Chinese kids that she studied. Dominicans were very much involved in their ancestral home, and Chinese were very much thought of themselves as ethnic Americans. And she argues that part of what explains this is bilingualism, the fact that the Dominican Republic is very close to the United States, different family contexts and parent-child relationships, and the existence of ethnic enclaves. Other people stress the way that transnational activities change over time. So the same kid who was interested in, who wasn't interested at all in their parents' home as an adolescent, or becomes very interested when they're going to be married, or when they're searching for values to teach their kids when they finally have children. And also use their contact back to their homeland to redefine what it means to be an ethnic American in the United States, and also to signal that they are different from other minorities, to signal that they're different racially, and to signal that they're different religiously. So Mexican American kids who reclaim Mexican Americanness at a later age because they want to say, I'm not black and I'm not Puerto Rican. Or the Irish Americans that I found in my study who knew very, very little about Ireland and had not gone back at all, weren't told very much about it by their parents, but then when they reach middle age, look a lot like the Mexican Americans or Dominican Americans in that they're raising money for soccer fields and raising money for economic development projects back in Ireland. Part of what this is about is a sort of emotional transnationalism, that as kids learn more about their homelands, they incorporate that into their sense of who they are. And they might not actually engage in transnational practices, but they can see that kind of attitude and that self-concept as advantageous in the world, whether it's to help them in a job or to help them overcome racism that they might experience in the professional arena. And I really want to emphasize, I think, the role of organizations in all of this. So many, the extent of, excuse me, transnationalism in a particular group really depends upon the organizational opportunities that a particular group faces. So in the Indian community that I've been studying, religious organizations really represent a very strong social arena to be tied back to India, because so many of those groups are still based in India and led by people in India, and so it really orients kids towards their ancestral home, whereas for the Pakistanis, they belong to mosques that more or less function as individual mosques. They're not part of organizational networks that go around the world, and so they don't fulfill a similar function for that community. So let me just turn. In the context of an increasingly ethnically diverse and transnational world, how does schooling interact with the hierarchies of inequality? And so does end up maintaining inequalities by producing the existing social order, or can schooling help overcome social inequalities by fostering opportunities for mobility? Now, when you grow up in a transnational social field, as I said, you're migrating both physically and socially and culturally, and that has implications for the educational experience. So, for example, in the Dominican community that I studied and wrote about in the Transnational Villagers, there were many kids that were circulating constantly within one school year back and forth between school in Boston and school back in the Dominican Republic. Or the homeland was a place where kids got sent, especially as teenage girls, because it was considered by parents to be a place that was more morally strong and also sexual values. There was less sexual freedom. And parents felt very much that since they were working so hard, they couldn't protect their kids from these kinds of influences. It's also a place where kids are sent back when they fail in school in the United States, and they're given a second chance in the Dominican Republic. So in the best case scenario, these kids who are circulating are both bilingual, bilingual and bicultural, and they can master both societies. And in the worst case scenario, you have kids that are socially excluded from both and marginal to both societies. Also, moving between multiple cultural and social worlds produces tension. So you have power hierarchies in households that are sort of reverted on their head because kids are much better at negotiating the host society than their parents. And so parents might live in an ethnic enclave where they're working among people who speak the same language. They might be living in an ethnic enclave. And so kids are much better at speaking English and also at negotiating the educational and healthcare and legal systems. And so you have the kids have a lot more power and a lot more responsibility and are forced to become the grown-ups in the household much before they want to do so. Now, parents communicate very mixed messages about how they should relate to the broader culture, just like Sonali and Bindi's parents did. They want kids to be culturally competent, but they also want to protect them from the bad influences in the surrounding society. So Suarez Orozco and Suarez Orozco, a husband-wife team who have studied the children of immigrants and the educational experience, found that parents really believe that becoming too American is bad for your achievement and bad for your mental health. And so as a result, kids are just as likely to see the school system as a place to be afraid of and a place to walk into with a certain amount of fear or just skepticism, I guess is a better word, as they are to see it as a place to go to sort of invert that social hierarchy and challenge that social hierarchy. And kids feel this kind of immigrant bargain, the pressure of the immigrant bargain that some have called, that they know that their parents have immigrated for them, that they have made these tremendous sacrifices, and yet they also want to break free of that cultural commitment that they've made and that cultural kind of pressure. Parents have very different expectations about what the host society is going to give them. So they, in many cases, they are more willing to accept poor working conditions or social marginalization because they're doing so much better than they did back where they came from. But kids have a different dual reference point. I think they see that they also feel optimistic and they see that they can progress, but they also see that they're excluded from a lot of the affluent lifestyle that the mainstream is participating in. And they're also confronting a lot of stereotypes and prejudices. So Claude Steele is a psychologist who's looked at how stereotypes affect academic performance. And he says that in a process that's called social mirroring, or sort of a kid assimilating an idea of themselves that they see mirrored back to them by the significant other, kids start to decline, their performance starts to decline. And so, and some people have called this oppositional culture, or what segmented assimilationist theory predicts as assimilating into that rejecting values of the mainstream and assimilating into that underclass culture that rejects that mainstream culture because it feels that it can't survive in them. So these are the kids that are more likely to drop out of school and to not do well in the labor market because they feel that they face overcomable barriers to their social mobility. Now, certainly schools aren't doing this alone, and there are economic and opportunity structures, the quality of the infrastructure, enduring racial tensions and stereotypes are really at play, and the types of neighborhoods that people settle in, the social capital that's available in those neighborhoods, and racial and ethnic differences really influence mobility trajectories. So there have been studies by Minh Jo and Bankston, of Vietnamese in Louisiana, for example, where they really emphasize the protective and social capital input of a tight ethnic community, because parents were always watching kids, because these ethnic neighborhoods joined forces to give after-school classes and to do tutoring and to do youth programs so that kids didn't get in trouble after school. The Vivian Lewis stresses the role of parents in their children's well-being, and her studies of Chinese Americans show how important it is, parents' expectations and their sort of setting down the law that only certain kinds of occupations and certain kinds of schools are acceptable also contribute positively to school performance. And finally, Feliciano and Portes and Rimbaud really stress the role of parental status, socioeconomic status. So in a study by Feliciano, she says she was looking at what explains why Latino kids are so much less likely to finish high school and go on to college than Asian kids, and 60% is explained by the parents' pre-migration status and their post-migration status. Okay, so to conclude, I think that in the 21st century, more and more people are going to belong to two or more places at once, and that their experiences drive home that homeland and host country concerns are not separate issues, and that both transnational and national outcomes are produced by forces inside and outside national borders. And so when a small group of immigrants are regularly involved with their homeland, and when a larger group is periodically involved when there's an election or when there's an economic downturn or when there's a hurricane or an earthquake or when there are particular life cycle events, their combined efforts add up and have the potential to change what's going on, the values and the economic growth in entire regions. And it's not necessarily the case that transnational actors care more about their homelands than they do about the countries that receive them. People can exercise rights and responsibilities in several communities at once, and their multiple memberships can reinforce rather than detract each other. We tend to think about these as a zero-sum game, and I don't think that they are. Because in today's world, I think people who know how to function in multiple societies, who are bicultural and bilingual, have an advantage over the rest of us. And because they can not only transmit ideas and values, but they can translate between cultural contexts. And what research finds is that transnational entrepreneurs are more likely to be U.S. citizens. In other words, the more you're integrated into the U.S. context, the more likely you are to be a transnational business owner, or that the same organizations that foster political integration into the United States are the same organizations that also foster continued involvement in Mexico, and or that students who are bilingual and bicultural do better in school because they're able to code switch, they're able to move between those two cultures. So the question is not really whether transnational lives are good or bad, but given that a lot of people are going to live them, what are their rights and responsibilities, or sort of how can we best protect them and represent them, and then what should states and communities expect in return? So thank you very much.
Però no en català. Molt bé. Diu que s'atreveix a fer el debat en castellà, no en català. Diu que encara no s'atreveix a fer-ho en català, però sí en castellà. Per tant, podeu intervenir. Si ho feu en castellà no caldrà traducció simultània, si ho feu en català ho podeu fer perfectament, hi ha el sistema de traducció, per tant no hi ha problema. I ella respondrà, com veureu, amb un domini prou... prou nivell de la llengua castellana. Tenim mitja horeta, no, 20 minuts
Per tant, us proposo que fem, com és habitual, un primer torn, que qui vulgui intervenir demani ara paraula, veiem quan som i després anem regulant el temps en funció de les intervencions. Qui voldria intervenir? Aquí hi ha una, hi ha algú més? Doncs comencem per aquí, sisplau. Sí, però igualment anirà bé el micro.
Gràcies. Jo volia saber només si en la recerca...
Ara m'has descol·locat, eh? Em sembla molt bé, però això del bilingüisme a vegades ens genera...
Sí, soy bilingüe.
No, ho pots fer en català, ja traduirà, eh?
És igual. Si han hecho también investigaciones al mismo tiempo de la relación que hay entre los guetos y esta circunstancia de la transnacionalidad. Si hay relaciones. Si cuanto más se vive en un gueto, más difícil es esto, y cuanto más transnacionalidad, cuanto más relaciones hay con las dos comunidades, la de origen y la de acogida, también menos tendencia hay a hacer gueto.
Recollim. Allà hi havia al final, no? Allà n'hi ha una. I algú més? Que m'havien dit per aquí, no? Doncs allà, sisplau, allà al final.
Mi pregunta tiene que ver con el hecho de que Estados Unidos se conformó como un país de inmigrantes y lo que quería saber es si a la hora de pensar en comparar el caso de Estados Unidos con el de Cataluña en este momento, si el hecho de que la constitución de Estados Unidos como país de inmigrantes influye.
Yeah. Okay. ¿Ahora contesto?
Sí, sí.
Okay. perdón. Sí. ¿Contesto?
Sí, contesto.
Okay. Perdón. a su pregunta atrás, ¿no? Yo creo que tiene mucho que ver. O sea, yo en estos días estoy aprendiendo mucho. Yo viví en Barcelona, así que tengo mucho cariño a esa parte del mundo, pero estoy aprendiendo recién sobre esa problemática inmigrante acá. Y yo creo que el hecho de que nosotros tenemos esa autoimagen de ser un país de inmigrantes, aunque estamos luchando con eso ahora, con todas las cosas de seguridad y todo, está allí bien, sus raíces están bien, bien estiradas. Entonces, sería, o sea, esto es lo que estuvimos conversando ayer en el otro seminario, cómo es que la gente en Cataluña y España piensan de su propia identidad y después si esa identidad puede ser mantenido cuando hay cómo esa identidad puede absorber o va a rechazar nuevos raíces, porque aunque no, nuevos sabores, digo yo, porque aunque nosotros hemos cambiado en cómo pensamos, ¿no? Que al principio pensábamos que los inmigrantes tenían que adaptar todos los valores de los protestantes anglos blancos, ¿no? Ya pensamos es más multicultural, que se puede mantener su propia etnicidad, ¿no? Pero tenemos esa idea de somos un país de inmigrantes y tenemos que incorporar tal como sea los que vienen. Y yo creo que a su pregunta, claro que es, estoy pensando en Washington Heights, en Nueva York, donde viven un montón de dominicanos. Así que es muy, muy fácil ser transnacional desde allí, porque tú sales a la calle y encuentras todo lo que necesitas, aún quizás con tus amigos de tu pueblito, entonces está allí, pero no creo que necesariamente depende en eso. O sea, se ve no han habido estudios formales, ¿no? Entonces mi respuesta es anecdótica, es mi opinión personal, pero también se puede ser transnacional viviendo como estas chicas en un pueblito que es más o menos blanco, ¿no? Y usted usó la palabra ghetto, pero también se puede decir enclave.
Enclave, sí, sí.
O para mí, ghetto suena algo mal. Y se ve que, y puede haber, seguro que hay ciertas barreras a la inclusión social que pasa cuando vives en un ghetto, pero también hay ciertas, también es una fuente de capital social que también ayuda a la integración también. O sea, no es o bueno o malo, hay los dos.
Sí, obrim un segon torn. Allà, sisplau, aquí n'hi ha una, aquí una altra, ja em demano també paraula. Tres.
Buenas tardes. Dos preguntas. La primera es cuánto influye en este caso la distancia cuando hablabas en el grupo de chinos y en este caso de grupos dominicanos. Estudios indican que bueno, es mayor quizás el vínculo transnacional entre salvadoreños, dominicanos, sí, quizás ecuatorianos también, guatemaltecos y mexicanos, ¿no? Sí. Caso particular hacia los Estados Unidos.
Sí.
En el caso de una segunda pregunta es ver si hasta dónde se sostiene esta tesis de que puede terminarse este vínculo transnacional una vez que estos hijos de inmigrantes o migrantes de segunda generación, si pueden llamarse así,
sí,
una vez que se asimilan o se integran a la sociedad receptora, uh-huh, se puede perder este vínculo transnacional. O el otro caso en que grupos que se dé un retorno masivo también se rompería. Entonces, algunos estudios indican quizás que bueno, se puede romper, pero quizás desde tu punto de vista no sé cuál sea, ¿no?
Okay. Yep.
Aquí n'hi ha una altra. Mentre no vens, aprofito i faig jo la pregunta. Dos qüestions. Una, ¿qué relación crees que existe entre las sociedades de acogida a la hora de aceptar o de no vivir como agresión la consolidación de identidades a partir de fenómenos de transnacionalidad distintas a las de acogida en aquellos países que son potencias de referencia en el orden mundial, la sociedad norteamericana, uh-huh, o en aquellos países que forman parte de una incidencia muy menor? Es decir, uh-huh, ¿hasta qué punto formar parte de una sociedad hegemónica, uh-huh, no facilita la capacidad de una buena relación de aceptación de la existencia de colectivos o de identidades diversas porque hay una fuerte seguridad en sí mismas, ¿no? Uh-huh. Y la otra pregunta, pensando ahora en los colectivos de inmigrantes, ¿hasta qué punto la transnacionalidad no guarda también relación con la distancia, no tanto física o geográfica como tú apuntabas, sino cultural con la sociedad de acogida? Es decir, ¿hasta qué punto pues un irlandés en Estados Unidos tiene menos necesidad de proyectos transnacionales que un pakistaní o que un dominicano, ¿no? Aquí n'hi ha una altra.
Son buenas preguntas.
Hola. Hace unos años derribaron el muro de Berlín y por lo visto se les olvidó una cosa que llamaban telón de acero, aunque no sé si era un telón, y parece que la sociedad occidental decidió que el mundo era un espacio globalizado y libre donde iba a poder irse y venirse con cierta facilidad, pero paradójicamente unos países están empezando a lanzar discursos muy claros, como en Uganda, aquí ya no cabe nada, ya son pros, lo que sea. En Estados Unidos creo que tienen ustedes un muro con la frontera de lo que en su día fue la de España o México, uh-huh, y hay un discurso ahí muy potente detrás. Uh-huh. Y hasta nosotros nos hemos permitido hacer una huelga en Ceuta, creo, y no en Ceuta.
Una valla.
Una, sí, sí, una, para que no entren personas de los pueblos que de una ciudad más o menos española. Eso también es una discusión que se llama Ceuta. ¿Qué pasa con Occidente y con esta paradoja? ¿Es aparente o es fundamental?
Molt bé, permeteu-me. Si hi ha alguna altra paraula més, la recolliríem, perquè no obriríem un altre torn, donat que estem ja arribant. Per tant, dues paraules més i alguna altra? No? Doncs, tenim a treballar ara, dues mans i... Vinga, doncs aquí, per aquí al mig...
Hola, yo lo que quería preguntar, bueno, al final cuando has hecho el resumen de conclusiones, no sé si lo he entendido bien o no, y por tanto la primera pregunta iría en relación a esto, en que has vinculado la asunción de la transnacionalidad por parte de los jóvenes de segunda generación con el éxito académico, ¿puede ser? O no,
no.
Bueno, después... Okay. En todo caso, ¿qué relación existiría o si existe algún tipo de relación y en referencia a los colectivos? O sea, si está relacionado con el éxito académico o no, en qué casos y en qué tipos de colectivos y qué influiría. Y también en relación a esto, y como condición de integración también de los jóvenes, ¿qué expectativas tienen en referencia a su formación académica a la hora de inserirse en los nichos laborales de la sociedad que los acoge, ¿no? En este sentido.
O sea, su identidad transnacional que tiene que ver con su inserción laboral.
Sí, okay. Exactamente.
Okay.
Ya está, gracias.
Y aquí davant.
A mí me ha sorprendido, si no he entendido mal, la... digamos la referencia que has hecho a la inmigración china en Estados Unidos. Porque uno tiene una imagen quizá totalmente falsa de que el colectivo chino es un colectivo en general muy cerrado en los países de acogida. Entonces, si no he entendido mal, has dicho que los chinos en realidad pierden el contacto con la sociedad de origen más que, por ejemplo, los latinoamericanos. Entonces, bueno, simplemente era una aclaración.
Okay.
Tienes una hora para hacer otra ponencia.
No, son buenas preguntas y no voy a poder contestar todos suficientemente. Sobre lo de la distancia. Claro que... tiene sentido que cuando es más fácil viajar y más barato, los lazos, la continuación de los lazos, pero no quisiera caer en la trampa de pensar que es solamente eso, porque también es que los países en el Caribe y los países latinoamericanos son mucho más bajo el órbito de Estados Unidos que otros países, pero también que no se necesita moverse, no es un prerequisito para ser un actor transnacional, ¿no? Porque todo eso, ese imaginario y lazos culturales, emocionales y afectivos. Y yo creo que no se sabe si va a bajar con la segunda después. Lo que yo pienso es que y no tenemos investigaciones todavía, pero lo que yo pienso es que vas a ver un nivel de dos cosas, y que cuando hablamos de una identidad étnica y una identidad transnacional, Yo creo que podemos hablar de un ethnic American y un transnational American. Y con eso quiero decir, para un irlandés americano, su identidad está más que nada informada por la experiencia de ser irlandés en Estados Unidos. Y para un transnational American, esta persona está más interesado en lo que pasa en Irlanda, ¿no? Pero si entendieron algo de mi charla, es que estos dos posiciones son muy bien relacionados y es más y más difícil separarse. Entonces, lo que yo pienso es que los niños no van a ser activos en la misma manera que sus papás, pero sí vamos a ver subidas y bajadas de activismo dependiendo de crisis económico, subida de racismo, o sea, eso va a su pregunta, de ya estamos viendo esa paradoja entre un bienvenido abierto sin condiciones y ya murallas, ¿no? Entonces, mucha gente pakistaní en mi estudio, por ejemplo, se sintieron muy bien acogidos en Estados Unidos, han tenido mucho éxito, están viviendo en casas preciosas, pero después del 11 de septiembre ya no, ya se dan cuenta que no es un bienvenido sin condiciones. Entonces ya están buscando a Pakistán como un lugar donde pueden sentirse realmente en casa, ¿no? O como una estrategia por si acaso, ¿no? Voy a poner dinero en el banco en Pakistán por si acaso, ¿no? Entonces vas a ver subidas y bajadas tanto con los papás y con los chicos, creo yo, ¿no? Porque también puede ser una ventaja, o sea, el punto sobre los chinos es que creo que la experiencia de los papás que vivían muy pobre en barrios chinos muy insulares, ya se ve que esa población está alcanzando un nivel de mejoramiento económico muy grande y hay muchos chinos chinoamericanos que están estudiando en la universidad. Entonces, sí, bueno, no había nada para tener lazos durante el régimen comunista, ¿no? O sea, no quisieron tener lazos. Ya están volviendo, tanto los papás y los mamás y los chicos, pero los chicos lo usan como una ventaja, o sea, yo puedo tener éxito profesional en el mundo bancario y de alta finanza si yo sé cómo hablar en chino, si yo sé cómo hacer negocios en China. No sé si me explico, pero es como una tarjeta extra, una ventaja extra que te hace tener ventaja en el mercado laboral. ¿Qué más? A ver. Yo creo que a tu pregunta, Jordi, que no quisiera reificar países, ¿no? Pero sí creo que países tienen diferentes niveles de confianza. Y eso tiene que ver con sus historias, ¿no? Si han sido persecutados. Que, por ejemplo, el idioma de catalán, que ustedes no pudieran hablarlo por tantos años. Entonces, sí, van a agarrar eso y no van a dejarlo suelto, ¿no? Pero entonces pero después de un tiempo, o sea, un país también cambia, la historia cambia, se pone más poderoso o no, tiene que ver más con el poder que nada, creo yo. Pero también es cuestión de cómo se siente en el mundo
y suficiente confianza de su propia identidad de poder dejar que nuevos hilos entren en la fábrica, en el tejido, quiero decir. Uh-huh. Yeah, yo creo que este es buen punto para terminar.
Molt bé, doncs moltes gràcies, Peggy. Molt bé, doncs moltes gràcies, sobretot per l'esforç de parlar en una llengua que tampoc era la seva. Molt breument, recordar-vos, 22 de novembre, propera conferència, ja ho rebreu, amb el professor Salvador Cardús, la construcció de les identitats des de l'escola, i dir-vos també, per a aquelles persones que tingueu interès, que els dies 27 d'octubre, 3 de novembre i 10 de novembre, que són 3 divendres consecutius, al matí tindrà lloc el primer simposi organitzat per la Fundació Jaume Bofill sobre immigració a Catalunya, on es presentaran diverses recerques que tenen a veure amb el coneixement i amb el fenomen de la immigració en el nostre país. Per més informació, doncs, us podreu adreçar a la Fundació, però com que no estic segur que tothom hagueu rebut la convocatòria d'aquest simposi, doncs preneu nota, és el divendres 27, el divendres d'octubre, el 3 i el 10 de novembre. Prou de publicitat, bona nit i fins la propera. Gràcies.
Molt bé. Moltes gràcies.
A ti. Realmente disfruté.
Ahora tendremos tiempo en la cena.
Sí, un poco, pues, tranquilamente.
Ahora hablaremos de todo lo que no tenemos
claro. Okay, muy bien.
Te dejaremos cenar, ¿eh?
Sí. Me dejarán.
Les dejaremos
tener.
Sí, por favor.
Sí.